I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
This episode is brought to you by Joule, the immersion circulator for sous vide by Chef Steps. Order now at chefsteps.com/joule.
Hey, 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 I'm Jimmy Carboni from Beer Sessions Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello and welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live on the Heritage Radio Network every Tuesday from 12-ish to around 1 o'clock, from Roberta's Pizzeria. And where is it, Nastasia?
Bushwick.
Bushwick. Bushwick. Brooklyn. Joined, as usual, with Nastasia, the Hammer Lopez in the studio. How you doing, Nastasia?
Good.
Yeah, got David in the booth, right?
Also good.
Yeah. We weren't here last week because I was in Barcelona. In fact, I just gave... by the way... if you have, a coworker, it's a good idea to bring them some crap back.
Sure.
So I went to Barcelona. First of all, I had for the first time that Spanish-style gin and tonic, although they're like, Catalan style. I'm like, okay, whatever, Catalan style, gin and tonic. So we can talk about that later if we have time. But I went to one of these old and very well-known bakeries in Barcelona. This one's called Colomina. It means honey, beehive in Spanish. And it's these hard candies they've been making since 1849. What do you think? They're weird flavors.
They're not good. Yeah.
What flavor is it?
It tastes like a cough drop, but it's called
Romero
Moromani.
I'll have to look it up. Some of them are herbal. That's some of them are fruity. Mm-hmm. They're all different. Anyway. Call in your questions to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. Also in the Cooking Issues style of news, this weekend, Sunday, is the first day of the Chow exhibit, the general one. Tomorrow we have our Kickstarter benefit, I guess, or VIP benefit or whatever. And then on Sunday is the opening. So if you want to head down to 62 Bayard Street, right off McCarran Park in Brooklyn. They say it's Williamsburg, but in the real life it's Greenpoint. We all know it's Greenpoint. Right, Sazmi?
Yep.
If you have to, so for those of you that have never been to New York, there's this horrible road called the Brooklyn Queens Expressway, the BQE, and it basically cuts a whole section of Brooklyn and Queens off from the rest of the universe, towards the waterline. And generally, once you cross under that, you're not in Williamsburg no more. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. What do you think, David? You agree with me on this?
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, I mean, McCarran Park, that's Greenpoint, yeah? Anyway.
Yeah, sure.
He's like, I don't really care.
I live really far away from there, so I kind of don't.
He's like, yeah. The thing is that, the individual neighborhoods in New York have become so hip that... So when I was, 20-something years ago, when I worked in a metal fabricating shop in Greenpoint, Brooklyn... called SFW, as in so blanking what metals. That was literally the name of the shop where I worked, inhaling black metal dust all day long.
But so what?
But there was no one there. I mean, it was the idea of a hipster. When you told someone you were moving to Greenpoint, they're like, where? Mm-hmm. What? Now it's so hip in Greenpoint that the people in Greenpoint never leave Greenpoint. So they're like... In other words, the point being that they're so insulated there in Greenpoint land that, why be so close to Manhattan? What's the point?
It could be anywhere.
Could be anywhere.
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 Columbus.
Columbus,
Cleveland,
yes. Exactly.
Kansas City.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not like... It's not
There's
like
those... hipster hubs in those places.
Sure. And, I guess there is a theoretical G-train connection from Greenpoint to the rest of New York City.
But not really.
No, it's kind of just theoretical, right?
Yeah, I mean, I live in Didymus Park, so that is definitely theoretical. It's 20 stops on the G or something to get from Williamsburg to Didymus.
How close is that to the Didymus Avenue stop on the F?
I'm about a 10-15 minute walk from that. I'm closer to the B in the Q.
Do you go to Train World ever? That's like an awesome huge model train shop right on Ditmas.
Nope.
Missing out. If you're a model train person, as my son Booker
is. I thought you were going to say as Nastasia is.
Would you imagine like the idea of Nastasia sitting in her room?
Work? You'll hear me talk about trains and then go home and hear Booker.
Yeah. Because all Booker likes is trains, but like subway trains only. But like I have this image of Nastasia going home, putting on one of those blue and white engineer hats. You know, those like caps.
Playing with my model trains.
Playing with your model trains all day.
Maybe it's her secret obsession.
And when I call, it's like you hear the clack, 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 clack. I'm like, what is that, Nastasia? Nothing. Shut up. Just running her model trains all day. That would be
the ultimate secret.
It would be
right?
Amazing. Because it's just not in your character at all. Like you have like five levels, like going all.
I
up
would
your walls.
Though have one like a Christmas train.
Oh, around the tree?
I would, yeah.
Do you want one?
I would, yeah.
I can bring some tracks home.
I don't have any room. If I have a big
I
basement.
Can give you the minimum size track for the tree. The minimum oval is 31.
But then I want all the little Christmas houses, too.
Now you're talking village. A lot. The minimum oval on an O-gauge train is 27 inches. It's called O-27.
That's small.
I'm telling you. You can get a small track, you know, but you have to only certain engines run on the O-27.
Maybe. Yeah.
The rest run on the O-31. Booker would loan you one of his Santa Fe's because he does not care. He only cares about a Santa Fe. I have plenty of track.
Do they have a Metro North one?
Now you're talking money. Once you're licensing stuff, like this one company, MTH, used to have the license for the subway, the New York City subway, until they put out a graffitied model. MTA was like, crap on you. So they gave it back to Lionel, but because it's an official license, Lionel like totally rakes you over the coals for the money. So what MTH did is they started selling non-licensed things that look exactly like the MTA things. They just don't have the MTA stickers, and then other jokers are selling the MTA stickers to stick on it.
Yeah, I would do that.
Of course you would. It's because you're just like me that way. You're like, yeah, I don't really care whether it's real or not. Just, you know, it's
a couple of scam artists.
For the Christmas tree, you know. Anyway. Well, it's a couple of scam. Please. Oh.
Oh, my God, Dave. If I did the MTA train, then you'd have to build, the Metro North, you'd have to build a little Leatherman.
Oh, my God. Village. Did we talk about Leatherman on the air?
I think so.
Yeah. We talked about Leatherman, right? The guy who walked around Connecticut, the guy who I would be, were it not for the fact that I have a wife and kids.
Maybe you didn't.
Leatherman? I don't recall that.
You don't recall Leatherman?
No.
So
is that like a dungeon kind of thing?
No,
leather daddy?
No, it's not.
Oh God, no.
It's not really cooking related either. But there's this guy. There's this guy, and nobody knows his real name. People say they know his real name, but they don't. All that crap was made up. They know he was like French-ish, like he could speak some French, kinda. And in the 1800s, from like, I guess just after the Civil War until he died in, I think, 1889, he would just walk a 300 and something mile trail, looping from Westchester right over by the Hudson by Ossining, all up over through into Connecticut, down the Connecticut River, and then along the shoreline and just loop it. And he would walk about 10 miles a day. Every day of the year, rain, wind, snow. The biggest blizzard of the century they had in the 1800s stopped him for, I think, 3 days, put him 3 days behind schedule. And he would just sleep outside under these rock overhangs, which they call Leatherman Caves, even though they're not actual caves because Connecticut doesn't have real caves. And, like, occasionally people would give him stuff to eat. And he sewed all of his clothing. There are pictures of him. You can look him up. They sewed all of his clothing out of discarded boots that he cut the tops off of and laced them all together into this, like, big, like, outfit. So there are Photoshopped images of my face over the Leatherman's body.
Why?
Because I would if it wasn't for the fact that I had kids and a wife, you know.
Those are your only anchors to prevent you from spinning out of control into that world?
Pretty much. Yeah.
You wouldn't do Civil War reenactment.
I would do Leatherman.
Leatherman
reenactement. Someone already did it, though. Someone already did
the
Leatherman.
Well,
the other reason. Look, like, I have a place in Chester, Connecticut, and he used to walk through Chester, and like I spent a good portion of my childhood in Chappaqua / Mount Kisco, New York, and he used to walk through Mount Kisco. In fact, he died on the Westchester side. So basically, I'm already living the Leatherman life anyway. I'm already so cheap that I'll walk anywhere for no reason, like without having, you know.
But what's the point?
What's the point of anything? He's just walking.
So existential.
You know, it's like
I know, but what would the point be for you?
Point for me?
Yeah.
What else am I going to do? I've already lost my house because I haven't paid my bills. I've already, like...
Wait, this is hypothetical.
I'm saying if I didn't have a family to tack me down, you know what I mean? I'd be I'd be a nightmare. Anyway, so back to cooking-related things. By the way, we had a question a couple weeks ago on hickory syrup, and I report back that I made some. So hickory syrup is not like maple syrup in that you don't make it from the sap of hickory. You make it from the bark. And you know what? Okay, so for those of you that don't know, the most famous kind of hickory tree, in terms of the nuts anyway, is called the shagbark hickory. And there are some other ones. Many of them have awful flavored nuts, like the pig nut hickory taste and the bitter nut hickory clearly are terrible tasting hickories. There's also the mocker nut, which doesn't, I don't think, taste bad, but it's just very difficult to crack, and the shell bark, which is a variant on the shag bark. But anyway, I digress. So the nuts are delicious. And you know, we've talked about it a couple of years ago. We went on a hickory nut kick. We love hickory nuts. Hickory nuts are awesome. I love them. They're delicious. They are like, you know, pecan is a good nut, which is closely related to the hickory nut. But the hickory nut is actually, in my opinion, a superior nut, just much harder to get to. So, and smaller than a pecan. So the pecan wins from a commercial standpoint. Whatever. Whatever. And Nastassi, that's another thing you don't like, right? Pecan pie?
No, not really. No.
Oh, my God.
I like your pecan sours.
Yeah, those are good.
Yeah.
Remember, well, Nastassia, we won't get into it because it's not family friendly what Nastassia did at the event where we were making those things.
No, that was Mindy.
Oh, yeah. No, that was you. You got so angry they wouldn't let you behind the bar at the YMCA. It's not safe for work, mm-mm, what happened in that situation. That's, you know, for the next time we have an unexpurgated cooking issues, then, you know, someone can call in and request that they get the Nastassia Lopez YMCA pecan story.
Let's do that. We'll get Johnny Walker to sponsor.
Yeah, all right. We can say that we made it with Johnny Walker. Who knows? I mean, I don't even remember what we made it with you.
No.
I have no idea. Anyway, I just remember the story, the anger, and, well, whatever. Gotta get it involves dietary laws. It's a nightmare.
Religion. So
it's religion, dietary laws, Nastassia's, lack of respect for either. Anyway, so... So back to hickory. So shagbark hickory, one of the interesting things about it is that it is one of the most aptly named trees that exists. The bark looks shaggy, almost like a 60s rocker's feathered out hair. You know what I mean? Like it just comes off in big kind of strips and it's layered as it comes down the tree and it peels off. What that means is you can harvest the bark rather easily without damaging the tree because you can just rip off the pieces. In fact, I have some pictures of the bark. I'll post it later. You know, after I post my obligatory post for, you know, who, Nastassia is getting mad at me. Because it turns out if someone pays you money, you have to do a certain number of posts, and they don't pay you the money until you've done said certain number of posts, and I'm terrible at that. And so Nastassia has been riding me like a trick pony for like a week and a half. Just put up the last post.
Yeah.
Whatever, please. Okay. I'm a bad man. It's stipulated. So the so anyway, so someone asked me about making it, any tips or tricks that I had. So I went out into the woods because I know where I have a shagbark hickory. It's actually on the neighbor's property, but whatever. What the hell do they know? They're not using it. So I went up and I ripped some of the bark off without damaging the tree. And by the way, so I didn't measure anything, but I harvested enough for about 3 liters of syrup, and I harvested it in like under 2 minutes because it's just like snap, 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 walk out. Now, here's the techniques I used in case you know. I thought it came out very well, so you follow these techniques, again, with no measurements. I took them back inside. I scrubbed them to get any sort of moss, lichen, or, like, you know, buggy, like, you know, caterpillary, tenty craps off of them because that's gross. I then snapped it into pieces that would fit into my oven. I toasted them in the oven. Well, I baked them in the oven at 350 to 375 for like 10, 15 minutes until I started to get the aroma out. Opened it, the oven, let them flash off and get dry. Snapped them into small pieces, fairly small pieces, like, I don't know, like an inch and a half. I wasn't too anal about it. Here's the one kind of tech trick I did. I then put them in a vacuum machine and sucked a vacuum on them in water like 2-3 times to infuse them rapidly so that they'd be rapidly infused with water, wouldn't float at the top. I thought that was a good idea. Then I put them into a big pot with water. I covered it and added a little more, but I wanted to keep it people have problems with this becoming bitter, and so I didn't want it to become bitter. And usually the way you do that is you do relatively quick steeps with relatively large amounts of product in into not as much water. So I did that, and then I brought it up to a boil, turned it off, covered it, let it steep for a while, kept checking it. When it was brown but not too bitter, I strained it, discarded the bark back outside. Then I reduced the product down by a factor of two. So I started with about 4 liters of stuff, liquid, four and a half. I reduced it down actually more than twice, reduced it down. Then after it had been reduced down to a little less than half, I added equal weight in of sugar, stirred it into a syrup, and that was it. And it was good. So the things I recommend if you have a vacuum, you do a vacuum infusion so that you have the water on the inside really quickly. I recommend like bringing it up to a simmer, then letting it steep and keep testing it while it's going so it doesn't get too bitter. And then I recommend draining and then reducing it substantially to increase the flavor profile before adding the sugar. And I've used it so far in I made an old fashioned with it that was delicious, in my opinion. And that was just, you know, 3/8 of that hickory syrup and 2 of whiskey and a dash or 2 of Ango and an orange twist. I also, because it does have some tannins in it, has a slight bitterness in the back, I used it in a shaken sour, which was actually interesting, but not with bourbon. I did a daiquiri. I did an aged rum, egg white, hickory syrup daiquiri, and it was really good. And some of the egg white. Interestingly, I also tested that recipe, Nastasia, just for giggles. I tested it in an ISI whipper, an EC whipper, to see what would happen. I was like, you know what? I hate doing cocktail foams, right? I've always hated doing cocktail foams, so I don't do it. But since I don't have a bar anymore, I can kind of do whatever I want. So I was like, what if I were to put this cocktail into like a foamer with the egg white? So I did a dry shake in the thing. Then I added the ice, shook it, added that nitrous, shook it, and then pumped the cocktail out. And Nastasia, the cocktail filled like 3 glasses. One cocktail filled like 3 glasses, 100% foam, 100% foam, no liquid. I was like, what the hell am I going to do with this? But it was good, but like, do you want to drink a foam?
You can put it on pie, right?
Oh, that's a good idea, like a cocktail pie. Eventually it settles out, but you have like minutes. You have on the order of like minutes.
Yeah, if you put it on like a pumpkin.
That's a good idea. A daiquiri on top of a pumpkin pie? That'd be good.
That'd be really good.
Yeah, nice. I mean, it needs to be contained a little bit, so maybe you'd have like some pie in the bottom of a cup, mm-hmm. like a parfait cup, mm-hmm. and then some of that stuff on top. That's smart. That's smart. I like pumpkin pie.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I know?
A little bit tipsy on the foam.
A little bit. In fact, I could probably dope it back with cream, too, and make it, like, really. Now you have little Jaquan going through my head. Everybody in the club. Everybody in the club get tipsy. Anyway, so that was what, that's my results with hickory syrup. And thanks for whoever brought it up so that I could test it. I recommend going out and foraging for that crud. Here's a question on Friars from 80 in Russia. You've spoken about this before, but I can't find your answer. Like espresso machines, traditional deep fryers, and British fish and chip shops, what do you think about the fish and chips as opposed to, like, French fries, chips? What do you think about calling them chips?
I guess they called it first, right?
Who says that?
I don't know.
They're not called British fries.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Traditional deep fryers in British fish and chip shops worked by the thermal mass of the huge fryer warming up, fired by gas, and recovering after the addition of bucket loads of cold potatoes to make chips. I see commercial line fryers, meaning continuous fryers, I guess, that make potato chips like Lay's or tortilla chips that have PID controllers and internal conveyor belts to move the product through the oil. If I want to increase consistency and temperature recovery, is it worth adding a PID over the thermostatic control on a benchtop electric deep fryer? Best 80, a cold Englishman in Moscow, Russia. And P.S., before I answer this question, P.S., Nastasia, mm-hmm. is there any chance you could get Mark Ladner on to talk about the Del Posto cookbook on the air? I, for one, am interested.
He said he'd do it next Tuesday.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
All right, there you have it. Next Tuesday, people. Tune in. Be ready for it. If they're still talking to me, next week on Monday is the first installment where I go to Oto, you know, the Mario Batali's pizza restaurant.
And I have to go all the time, right? Every time you're there.
If you don't, I'll murder you. And so I have to prep. So I'm going to Oto, and I'm going to be making cocktails behind the bar at Oto. So I'm doing a I think I'm using I'm doing a carbonated Amaro, like, you know, spritzer with probably with lime, and I'm doing a apricot into bourbon, Justino, and I'm going to do a Italian basil nitro muddled gin sour. Hmm. What do you think?
We'll see.
I think I'm going to add a little bit of Strega to that son of a gun.
How long are you there for? How many hours?
Like, I don't know. I think from, like, something till close. What time do they close?
4.
In the morning? A pizza joint?
4, right? Yeah.
Really?
I mean, their bar.
I don't think I'm going to be there till 4. I mean, I don't know. It doesn't really matter. As soon as my kids are asleep and my wife's asleep, it doesn't matter what time I come
home. Go straight Leatherman, yeah.
Yeah, go Leatherman to start walking. They're like, where are you going?
Straight Leatherman.
Go straight Leatherman. It's like, well, I got to get up out of the city so I can get back on my loop. He didn't like traveling in cities because people in the cities used to pick on him, so he would avoid the... He would avoid the main, the main routes. And for those of you that don't know, who've never been to the Northeast here, like a lot of that kind of land where he used to walk around is forested now. But back in the day, wasn't. It was all cleared. There weren't a lot of, like, you know, forested trees around. That stuff's all second growth. Mm. So, yeah, so he would just, like, there'd just be these rock outcroppings where he'd go hang out and, like, you know, cook whatever in the heck he was eating. Because he also had, I think, like a tin pot. Apparently, he, a lot like me, he would carry like 60, 70 pounds of gear around for no reason. Just for no reason. Like all the time. He's only walking 10 miles a day.
So did you say the encroachment of civilization is hurting Leatherman?
Well, he did. He died. He had cancer.
Oh, he's dead. No,
oh, yeah. He
part.
Died in the 1880s. Yeah, yeah. He was doing this in the 1880s.
He may have come back. As him.
I think I may have come back as him. Like he had a some sort of horrible mouth cancer that was eating away at his lips for the last year, year and a half of his life. And someone tried to take him to the hospital. He's like, and then got back out and started walking again. Now that's commitment. You know what I mean?
Never stop.
Never stop. Don't stop till you drop, man. That's it.
Boom.
It's like, why are you why do you engineer, Dave? Like, why are you sitting there engineering? I'm just because they pay you, but why do you need the money? So you can eat. Leatherman ate. He didn't have any money. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? It's like, what's the reason of doing anything? He's like, I'm walking. Anyway.
So we should all just walk is what you're saying?
No, I'm saying it's like, you know, he had a goal. I'm going to walk 10 miles a day. I'm going to carry my crap with me. I'm going to wear boots.
Was that his goal to do 10 miles a day or that was just incidental?
I think it was incidental, right?
He was pretty much, he was like a watch. People were like, it's time for the Leatherman to come around.
But and he, then, wasn't like, he wasn't like a pro walker. He was just like... A survivor.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, so if he liked you, like, if he didn't really want to talk to you, so there's this one group that took a, like, that, like, would give him soup or whatever, and he'd stop by and he'd take it. He wouldn't talk to him or anything. But one time they set up, like, a camera with a sheet over it, and then as he was sitting, they dropped the sheet and took the picture, and there's this picture of him where he has this kind of, like, look on his face.
I thought this was in the 1800s, you said?
They had cameras in the 1800s, man. Get with it.
Yeah, but didn't it take, like, hours for it to take a photo?
This is, like, the 1870s. I think it's a little bit better than, like, in the 1860s.
I'm not up on my history of photography.
I mean, it wasn't, like, instant. But anyway, they surprised him.
They weren't Polaroids.
Right. He never went back to that house again. So, like, what happened is, like, if you were nice to him and he, like, liked you, he would come back to your house every 34 days.
But did he talk?
Not much.
There's a lot of holes in this story. Don't you think, Nastasia?
I mean, look, I've read all of the relevant literature.
Dave has read everything.
Yeah.
So
the point is that he would just show up, and then, but if you were mean to him or like were like trying to force him, he'd be like, he'd never show up again at your place. He's like, I'm done with you. Give you wide berth.
It's kind of a good thing, right? If he doesn't show up.
And everyone wanted him to show up. At that time in the U.S., there were a lot of what's called anti-tramp laws because a lot of people were roaming around. A lot of people were displaced from like traditional farmland, traditional jobs. So there was a lot of wandering, a lot of tramps, like hobo style, but like earlier. And they were widely hated, and a lot of people like passed anti-tramp laws. And in fact, there was lots of beatings, murdering of tramps. People like had doing all sorts of terrible things to vagrants. So this is not just a modern phenomenon. He was the one exception. People were like, yeah, anti-tramp law, but don't mess with the Leatherman. No. You know what I mean? In fact, like these one group of people basically got the snot beat out of them for messing with the Leatherman.
Can you post a photo?
Of the Letterman?
I told you to post a photo.
Yeah, actually, chat room just linked me to the Wikipedia page, and there's some photos
there's
on
here. There's a better photo.
Nastassia's talking about the one that's my face on the Letterman's body.
I didn't
spend that much time photoshopping it. Like, I didn't, for instance...
Although it's a perfect... Look. It's in black and white.
What you really want to do if you're going to fake the photo is obviously pose yourself in the same sort of pose that the person was in and try to match the angle of the camera. I just, like, found the fastest photo I could find on the internet, cut out my face, and stuck it onto the Letterman's body.
And really, if you wanted to go full method, you would have to be, like, living like Leatherman for at least a week or so just to get into that mindset.
I think it takes a couple of years. I'd have to learn French, first of all, and then not speak it to anyone. That would be like the first thing. I mean, I used to know some French, but not enough. Anyway, back to the question. But we were talking about here. Should I add a PID controller to my fryer so that I can approximate what happens in continuous frying, AD? And the answer is no, you should not. And here is why. Or as Myhrvold would say, here is why you should not. Right, that's a mix between Myhrvold and my professor Raymond Goyce from
college.
Or as
Leatherman would say, pourquoi?
Yeah, or just, that's what he would say. You're like, Leatherman, how was the food? And then he would just walk away. Anyway, you're trying to get me back off, Dave? You're trying to get me back off topic?
I don't like the way you phrase that sentence.
Anyway.
Trying to get me
off. Come on. This is one of the family shows. So anyway. You don't want to do that. Here's why. In a continuous frying is exactly what it says it is. It's continuous. That means you don't want any change one way or the other. They're typically very long, and they're very, very highly regulated. So, the first like 200, 300, 400 pounds, I don't know, it depends on the size of the line, but the first whole bunch of stuff that comes out of the fryer is not going to be right. It'll be over, it'll be under, whatever, until everything comes into equilibrium. And so typically these things take a long time to calibrate, but then they run them for, forever. So, like, they have a PID controller on their oil because they want to keep the oil at a certain place at exactly the same temperature. They know that they're adding X number of pounds of potatoes or tortilla chips every hour, and they eventually know what average heat input they need into the oil to keep it at the right point. And there's a gradation definitely in the oil temperature from the beginning of the line to the end of the line, but everything stays constant because they have a relatively constant heat input, they have a really relatively constant potato input, and they're also adding fresh oil, because the miracle of continuous frying, the miracle of it, is that you absorb oil, you add oil at the rate that it is absorbed by your potato or your tortilla chip, and if you get everything just right, then the oil is always perfectly conditioned, because brand new fry oil is not good and old fry oil is not good. The reason brand new fry oil is not good is it actually is too pure, and it doesn't transmit heat as well to the chips. A little bit of breakdown makes it slightly more polar and transmits the energy much better to the chips. So you actually want it to slightly break down, but you don't want it too much. And so in a continuous fryer, you can keep everything perfect by adjusting the rate of product in, potatoes or tortillas, and the rate of oil in, so that the oil in there is constantly right. So it's all about juggling these kind of – that's why you can't make just a few things in a continuous fryer. And for that, PID is perfect. Perfect. Everything is perfect all the time. The oil is always the same. The potato chips or whatever are always the same. Everything takes exactly the same amount of time. Awesome. By contrast, in batch frying, you are dumping a load in to a single batch. The temperature is going to drop, and you need to get that temperature back up. Now, here, you don't want a PID. Now, you could have a PID that realizes, but it's just very aggressively tuned, so that it rockets back up close to your finished temperature, but then knows to slow down a little bit as you're coming up so that you don't overshoot a lot. So there might be a situation where you could win over a standard like bang bang thermostat, but depending on the amount of temperature rise you're going to get. Usually, let's say you dump a bunch of stuff into a deep fryer and temperature drops real low, it turns the heat way on, and you're rocketing up through to your set point. Now, if you have only a small amount of product in there, maybe it can overshoot a lot, but odds are, by the time, if your fryer is really powerful, by the time it hits that hits back at its temperature, you're still boiling a lot of water off out of your product, so you shouldn't get that much of a rise out of it, theoretically, especially if you have good convection in it, which is why real tube fryers are awesome, because they don't tend to locally overheat your oil, because they have a much larger surface area to put heat into the oil. Anyway, so If you have an actual commercial fryer with a Bang Bang thermostat on it, it doesn't tend to overheat your oil, and they're pretty awesome. And really, you don't need single degree control over the oil temperature anyway. You just don't want it to get too low, and you don't want it to go high, and you want your recovery to be fast. So I would say no, do not PID it. Although, the converse, I'm going to go back. I want to say, if you're going to pot fry, I think having a using one of those controlled like induction units for frying can be very useful, because it's very hard at home to pay attention to a fryer all the time when you're doing a bunch of other stuff, and it's very easy to overheat your fry oil on a stovetop. And so one of these inductions, like the Breville one that I got sent or any of the other ones, can be very useful in keeping your fry oil so it doesn't go up too high. And certain of those, like the Breville, can have like an aggressive setting where it can get back up to its temperature aggressively. It's not as much as like on-off, but it's much more aggressive than the more standard PIDs. And a lot of PID technology, by the way, in terms of cooking, and a lot of what's different between different circulators is how aggressive their strategy is. A more aggressive strategy will get you to the temperature faster but have some overshoot. Anyway, what do you think, Stas?
Good job.
Okay. Anthony from Nashville writes in about Booker and Dax. Hey, Dave, Hammer, David, and guests. I was wondering if you could talk a bit about closing down Booker and Dax and the process of finding a new location. What you'll be looking for in a new spot, and what kind of changes will you include in the new bar, and why? Maybe it's me, but it seems like you didn't talk about it too much on the show, which is why I had to get information from the internets. Sorry if I'm bringing up a sore subject. Anyway, you guys are great. Love the show, Anthony from Nashville. Well, the problem, Anthony, is that there's only so much that I can say because I'm not allowed to say like exactly like who's going to be involved or what you know, what the arrangement is going to be, what the name of the bar is going to be, et cetera, because we're all in negotiations for these things at the moment. I can say this. I'm looking for space. I've looked at several spaces. I haven't found a space yet that I think is right. As for what's going to be different or the same, you know, what I want to be this, I think the core of Booker and Dax was the bar. The core was that we were going to work very hard to make the drinks as good as we can make them and present them in a non-pretentious style. We were, you know, using new techniques and trying to focus on working on flavor. So it's a very specific idea behind drink creation. And from a customer service standpoint, we really wanted it to be, like I say, friendly and non-pretentious and, you know, a place that you'd be comfortable to go and hang out and have some fun. So that was the goal. I think there, you know, we hopefully, I think, succeeded on those two counts. I think in the future, I want to I'm interested now in the fact of why people go to the bars, and I think it's to feel awesome, right, Stas? Like, yeah. I think you want to look awesome. Not necessarily that everything looks awesome, but that you feel like you look awesome, you feel like you are awesome. I think that's almost – it's not almost. It's more important than the drink, right? Like, the fact that you feel kind of special or, like, that, you know that you just feel good. Like, why else would you go to a bar? If you want to feel crappy, you go home. You know what I mean? Not that going home makes you feel crappy, Stas. I'm not saying that. But so I'm going to focus on those kinds of things more in the next go around. Not that we didn't focus on them before, but I'm going to kind of put those in prime place. And also, I want to make our carbonation system a little better. You know, there's a bunch of like tweaks and things. Depending on the people I'm working with, new techniques might be available to us that weren't before because I was so. I might not be as vehement about not using some techniques. I don't know. Will we use garnishes? I don't know. I doubt we'll use a lot of garnishes. We're never going to be a garbage heavy cocktail bar with garnishes, but I don't know. It's yet to be seen. So it's not that it's a sore subject. It's just there's certain things I can't say. And I found also that, like, until you have something concrete to say, it's usually, you know, best not to say much at all. Right, Stas?
That's true.
Yeah. Jeff from Los Angeles writes, hey, gang, I recently got into brewing, and I'm thinking about using a circulator to do a brew-in-bag all-grain setup during mash, running the circulator outside the bag and probably with a hop sock. What do you think about that word, hop sock?
What does that mean?
It's like, you know, like
isn't like a dance you go to in high school?
Now you have like at the hop, but like going through my head. But no, it's like a bag to hold the hop so that they can pull them back out again. Around the circulator as insurance in case anything escapes the bag. It looks like Enova tacitly approves this based on the 2015 interview they did on brewing beer with the Enova. But the owner's manuals for each of my circulators, I have a Polyscience Professional and an Enova 1, state that they shouldn't come into contact with food, in quotes. I also contacted Enova customer service, and they said no to what was done in the article. So what's the deal? Is this safe to do with either or both of my circulators? If so, is there any particular cleaning that you recommend before or after to ensure long life for the circulators and that no off flavors are imparted to the wort? Thanks for your help. FYI, you, meaning me, Nastasia, yelling at you, Nastasia, and Peter during the carbonation segment a few weeks ago was some of the most best comedy I've heard on the podcast. Jeff from Los Angeles. Also, I stand corrected. The Blue Man episode, which was the not safe for work, was even funnier. So there you go. Yes. Not a family show. So here's the thing. There's a bunch of reasons why people don't say things are food grade, and I can tell you this as an equipment designer. One, they simply don't want to pay to get it certified as food grade. So, for instance, the original Polyscience stainless steel circulators didn't have NSF approval, even though everything in contact with the food was, in fact, food grade. Now, there's two issues that you come across with. Well, there's a bunch of issues. A, is the food gonna harm the unit? The answer in most of these cases is no. You don't want to clog it, right? So you want to make sure nothing can clog the circulator part. But in general, no, the food's not gonna hurt the thing. Two, although I forget which one it was, but one of the lower priced circulators would not circulate oil. You remember that, Stas? Were you at that with me?
No.
Yeah, it was Wisconsin. It was in Wisconsin. We were doing that demo with Johnny and Hunter, and we couldn't get the one circulator to go in oil because we were doing that oil water test. Anyway, I think that's either the viscosity was a problem or one of the sensors was like, this is weird, and it didn't sense right, so it wouldn't work. But that was oil. Is the food going to hurt the unit? No. And then there is the unit going to hurt the food, and this can be in one of a number of ways. One, the material itself could be unsafe for food contact, i.e. poisonous, or what most people worry about is oils from bearings or plastics leaching out nasty stuff into the food, right? So that's the primary concern. In the old circulators, there were no – like the stainless steel Polyscience ones, there was nothing in contact with the food. The bearings were all up top, and it was all just a stainless steel impeller. There was literally nothing but stainless steel in contact. So I'm going to take that one as the base. And also, the newer Polyscience ones, they're not rated for food, but the plastic, I believe, is food safe. I had this conversation with Philip Preston, but it was years ago. I can't speak about the plastics that are used in the Enova, but I will say this. In general, most of these designers would only ever specify food grade plastics simply because why wouldn't it cost a little more, but in general they know that people are using it for food contact, and even if they're not going to go get the ratings for it, they would make it that way anyway if they're good people, which most of them are. Okay, so back to what we were talking about. And the Juul, I don't know, did we ask Chris Young on the Juul whether or not we'll find out, because you know he sponsored the show, in fact, so we'll find out whether or not that one is a food grade. But the materials in general are food grade. They're in contact with the material, with the food. So that's not an issue. But even if it is a food grade material, you have to get special certifications. The factory charges you more for those certifications of food grade. And finally, you have to get NSF approval for it, which is an actual certification, which also costs tens of thousands of dollars because we're going through it with the centrifuge, getting our NSF approval. So there's that, but the difficulty in getting the NSF approval isn't solely based on the materials it's made out of, but also how easy the material is to clean. So any portion of the unit that can't be disassembled and cleaned in a way that the people who are certifying it are happy with means that it's not going to get NSF approval. So in fact, even the centrifuge is another example. Certain design parts of the centrifuge are actually not ones that I like. I hate them, but I have to have them there because the factories tell me that I won't be able to get NF certification, for instance, unless certain parts can be broken down and washed separately. So a lot of whether or not something is rated for food contact might be whether or not the NSF people said that it could be washed out. Now, that said, that doesn't mean that you can't wash the stuff even if it's got like crevices. It just means it's more difficult to clean out. So as long as you're willing to take the time to clean it out, I would feel safe serving that stuff to my family. What do you think?
Yes.
Okay. Andrew writes in about pork. Andrew writes in about pork. I wanted to apologize for ripping on Dave the other week for disliking sweet tea. If I had known that he respected Eastern North Carolina barbecue so much, I would never have questioned his dislike of sweet tea. And for the record, if you get sweet tea in one of those amber-colored glasses, it's guaranteed to be too sweet. That's what we were talking about. In fact, I'm staring at some of those amber-colored glasses. Thank goodness they did not serve sweet tea in this establishment. Although they do – basically, they serve their lemonade here as a concentrate, and you have to add water to it. What do you think about that concept? Do you like the fact that you get more lemonade for your money?
No. It's expensive lemonade.
Right, because you're supposed to mix it with water.
But they don't tell you to mix it with water.
That's the thing. They don't tell you to mix it with water. So, like, a friend of mine was over yesterday, and someone was serving him coffee. And they have this way they're serving the coffee, and the coffee is too cold for his taste. And they're like, we want to serve it at that temperature. He's like, I just want my coffee hot. If you're going to serve coffee at some non-standard temperature, standard temperature for coffee in the United States is piping hot, like crotch scalding, McDonald's suing hot, right? So if you're going to serve your coffee at any temperature other than that, you have to be like, the guy's like, but then you have this happen. Hey, I want a coffee, right? And then you're like, sir, I don't know. Are you sure you want a coffee? Because the coffee we serve is like kind of like lukewarm. And he's like, well, what do you mean? He's like, and then you have to go through the whole rigmarole. This is why it's hard to do anything that's outside the norm when you have something that already has like a fundamental, like everyone knows the way it's supposed to be served. There's going to be some mishigosh, but I don't think you want to have that happen after the person has a cup of coffee that they think is too cold.
Yeah.
Because the guy that I was with at dinner, he's like, I don't care. Where's the hot coffee? What can I do to get coffee that's hot? Do you like coffee that's not hot?
No.
You like it hot?
Right.
Yeah. Anyway. Back to Andrew's question. As I mentioned, I live in Boston. I'm unable to cook outdoors and have trouble smoking food indoors because of the poor circulation in my apartment. I miss Eastern North Carolina barbecue terribly. I miss going to a pig roast with one of those big oil drum grills and just pulling some meat off of a carcass. What do you think about pulling meat off a carcass?
That sounds terrible.
Yeah, but that's fun, though. Any advice on replicating it here? It probably goes without saying that I can't cook a whole pig in my closet-sized kitchen, but I want the spicy, sweet, vinegary, smoky, meaty flavors of Eastern barbecue pork. I'm completely open to covering my cooking smoke detector if it could help, but I'm not sure what the best way to do this is without endangering myself or losing my security deposit. I have a baby-sized oven. Ooh, cooking babies. Terrible. Terrible. A circulator, a torch, an EC whip, a crappy coil electric stove, and a toaster oven, if those would help at all. Speaking of my circulator, I was given an Anova Precision Cooker circulator. I want to use it with other fluids such as oil and vinegar, but also don't want to ruin this wonderful gift. I know officially – I forgot this was even here. I shouldn't use anything with water, but I'm wondering if you know enough about this specific circulator. Let me know if I'm safe to use other fluids. So I can't remember whether it was the Anova or the Sansair that wouldn't pump oil, but it came back to life, so you're not going to hurt it by doing the oil. It's not going to hurt the unit. Let me put it that way. I'm still catching up on the Cooking Issues podcast, but I've learned so much from you guys. It means a lot to amateur cooks like me that someone like yourself is interested in our questions. Keep on being great, Andrew. Very nice. Okay. So what would I do? So here's the thing. So let's just get over talk about traditional, like, North Carolina-style pulled pork. So you're supposed to do, in the real world, I mean, like, old school, what you're supposed to do is chop wood, burn wood down to basically coals, put a whole hog on – split onto – you know, on there and cook it. I think flipping once, I think, for many, many, many hours at a low temperature, basically, breaking down the collagens, forming a nice what they call like a bark or crust of dryness around the outside. Then after many, many hours, the inside is moist and tender. The outside, you hack it up and you put a mixture of vinegar and cayenne pepper and regular pepper, over it and you eat it. Okay, so the good news about replicating this at home, and a lot of people get really bent out of shape about how to do it, is basically almost any low cooking technique is going to get you the internal structure, internal taste of the meat to be relatively accurate. So you'll find online many people doing slow cooker recipes or doing Kahlua style where you're wrapping the pork in aluminum foil and throwing it in an oven. And what that is doing is allowing you to get the high temperatures without drying it out too much. The problem is you're not going to have that crust on the outside, so people can get around it two ways. Now, if you're going to do it in a vacuum bag, which you can do, circulate it. The problem is you're never going to get a pulled pork texture doing low temperature. You're always going to need to do a higher temperature in order for it to break down. So if you, even if I cook like, let's say short ribs or pork, or pork belly, for, you know, days and days and days, so it's very soft, but I do it at a low temperature, the structure of the meat is never the same. It doesn't render out in the same way. So the structure of the meat is never the same as kind of a traditional pulled pork. So what I would do is get the traditional cut that people do when they do a single cut. And that's the Boston butt or the pork shoulder, section. Now, you can go wet all the way, but you're never going to dry out the outside of the meat, and it's never going to have quite the same thing. So what you can do is rub it down with salt. You can use a liquid smoke. The good news, I mean, I don't, but you could use like a liquid smoke. The good news about North Carolina, specifically Eastern North Carolina barbecue, is it's smoke. It's cooked in smoke, but it's not smoke-y. In other words, it doesn't taste overly smoked, so you're not going to require a lot of it. It's not like a heavy smoke cookery, even though it's in smoke for a long time. So you could put it in a low oven. Look up Meathead Goldwyn's recipes on this. You could do a combination of wrapping in foil and putting it in an oven, letting it come up, then take the foil off and then let it flash off. I would do some salt beforehand, and that's it. So you could definitely do it inside. But I would look up. I haven't done that specific one, but I would do it similar to the way they do a clue. What? I can't keep talking about pork. All right, hold on a second.
1 minute.
1 minute. Oh man, Pedro called in from Lisbon about melon pan. You know that kind of thing. And I actually have some. Let me see if I can get through this. I also had one more question. I guess I'm not going to get to on Jeremy on measuring alcohol. Jeremy, I'll get to you next week on measuring alcohol. Let's see if I can bust through this melon pan question. Good morning, Dave, Miss Lopez, David in the booth, and fellow members of the chat room. I'm Pedro from Lisbon, Portugal, and last June I visited Tokyo and Kyoto as part of my honeymoon around the world. There we tasted Japanese melon pan, and it's so good I want to try making it at home. And a melon pan, by the way, is like a bread dough, like a typical Japanese like semi-sweet bread dough encased in a cookie dough and baked. That's what it is.
Okay.
You like that idea?
Sure.
No melon inside.
Okay.
Okay. You know, if you saw it, you'd know it. However, I followed the recipe to the T and already baked them twice with different results. I would like you to explain, if possible, why the difference in the outcome. On both times, the outer layer, so this is the cookie layer, was difficult to work with, being very sticky and brittle, and I couldn't make a uniform layer. Does this have to do with the butter quality, as those fellow listeners from the bakery in Seattle had the problem? Does butter with salt or without salt have any difference, and could that explain the issue? I don't think so. On the first time, the bread dough also contains dry milk powder, by the way. On the first time, I didn't use dry milk powder in the bread dough and realized on the second time with the dry milk, the dough is lighter and more fluffy. What's the role of dry milk in the bakery? And these are from this recipe site called Japanese Cooking 101, their Japanese basic bread recipe and their melon pan recipe. Once again, thanks for the show. Pedro Paiva. Okay. P.S. You should visit Lisbon. Yes, I should. I would love to visit Lisbon. I love Portuguese wine. I love port. And I also love Portuguese cheese. Did you ever go to Portugal, Saz?
No,
I want to go to Portugal. I really do. So anyway, short answers to your question. Your problem with the cookie – I looked at the recipes, and let's hit the cookie dough first in case they rip us off the air. The video that they shot for the cookie dough, I don't know what they were doing in the video because the cookie dough they made looked fine, but the method they used for making it was terrible. They obviously didn't cream the butter and the sugar enough. You want to – first of all, take your butter out of the fridge. Don't bother warming it up. And according to Stella Parks, baker who writes for Serious Eats and has her own blog and all this other stuff. In fact, you shouldn't ever let your butter get above 68 when you're creaming. I don't know. I haven't run these tests, but she swears on 10 stacks of Bibles that that's the case. But here's what I do. I take the butter out of the fridge. I hit it with a rolling pin, turn it 90 degrees, hit it with a rolling pin a bunch of times, turn it 90 degrees. I go all the way around until it's malleable but still cold. Throw that into your KitchenAid or equivalent, hopefully with a scraper blade on it, with a silicone scraper. If not, you have to scrape down a bunch of times. Cream the heck out of that for minutes with the butter and the sugar to whip air into it. That's going to plasticize your dough. I think your main problem was that it was kind of too dense and wasn't uniform in structure, and so it was brittle. And also when there's not enough air whipped into it, once you chill it, because you had to chill the dough to roll it out, it's going to chill such that the outside's going to be be too hard and the inside's still going to be too soft. So in other words, uneven chilling might be an effect, and the denser your dough is, the less nice it's going to act when you're rolling it out once it's chilled. So anyway, so you cream the heck out of it. When you add the eggs, scrape down and whip those in until they're fluffy before you're adding the flour. And I think along with not over chilling it for a longer period of time, but not as hard, like don't freezer chill it, I think is going to make a big difference on it, because with more air, it's going to be more plastic. It's going to work better. It's not going to be brittle. I don't think it's your butter. I don't think it's the salt. I think it's strictly that if you follow the recipe the way they did it, they just didn't cream the butter for their cookies properly. As for the milk powder, the function can be different. Milk, depending on what's going on, whether it's a whole milk powder or not. If it's a whole milk powder, it has fat in it, and the fat is going to tenderize. But in general, as long as the enzymes have been deactivated in milk, which it usually is, I also don't know whether Japanese bread baking people 101 are using UHT milk, which has been completely deactivated from enzymes, which can reduce gluten, or whether or not they scald the milk beforehand. They call for lukewarm milk. But the milk powder in general, you get a browner version because of the sugars. You're adding extra lactose. Typically, you get a fluffier and softer product when you add milk powder. The actual mechanism, I'm not sure of. Anyway, so I hope that helps, and we'll get to the other questions next week on Cooking Issues.
Listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.